Next case on our calendar, 07-1144, U.S. Bank National Association versus Giuseppe Giolotta. Mr. McKenzie.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Tim McKenzie, and I represent Giuseppe Giolotta in this case. I would like to reserve, Your Honor, 2 minutes for a rebuttal, please.
Watch your time there on the clock.
First of all, I would like to refer the court to appellee's brief, page 9, because the appellee has set out a hypothetical, which I believe encapsulates the misunderstanding that the appellee has of our position, as well as the error that was made by the Fifth District. In the hypothetical, the appellee sets out a proposed foreclosure, then it's dismissed, and then he tosses in a reinstatement, and then a subsequent default and a new foreclosure. And in his hypothetical, he supposes that that our position would be that that would be barred, and that's incorrect. And throughout our brief and throughout our argument, we are saying that in promissory notes where there's an whether it's an acceleration clause or there's a cure of the default, that would reinstate the loan. And a reinstatement is nothing but a cure. And if the note is cured, then you go back to square one, and if that cured or reinstated loan would be then subsequently foreclosed on, the lender would be back in the same position and still be able to, Rule 41A, dismiss that cured or reinstated loan without the fear that they would be barred by the two dismissal rule.
Okay, counsel, I wondered about that when I was reading this, and I couldn't imagine that you would want to suggest that the two dismissal rule could put a bank or a lender in the position that they couldn't bring a foreclosure action if their the person to whom they had loaned the money defaulted again.
Yes, exactly.
And you're indicating that your argument is focused just on what happened here, and you're arguing that they were essentially foreclosing. It was the same foreclosure, first, second, and third time.
Identical. And to follow
but
up on
that. But it only changed by they added in a month.
Exactly.
But nothing different had.
They changed the prayer for relief.
But nothing different had happened between the borrower or the lender. Between one, two, and three.
Precisely, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, taken into this context, the position that the appellant holds in this case would actually encourage reinstatement of loans, because it would give the lender a new right to proceed again and Rule 41A dismiss if they so chose.
So your case is really limited to a fairly unique set of facts, apparently, where a foreclosure action was
filed
and dismissed.
I believe our fact pattern is pretty much identical to the fact pattern in the 10th District Court of Appeals case.
So would, under your scenario, if they filed and dismissed twice, then they're done?
If there is an acceleration and there's no cure.
Okay.
And there's no activity.
So at that point, your client is incentivized, that's the odd thing about this, to not pay anything more.
He wins with a procedural defect on the part of the plaintiff, as all plaintiff, or as, I'm sorry, as all defendants do when res judicata has its effect.
Does he ever have to make any payments at that point?
No, Your Honor. The
so he
case
gets to
would
keep
be
the house?
Pardon?
He gets to keep the house and not have to pay for it.
The plaintiff would be, as all plaintiffs are, when res judicata eliminates their cause of action, the defendant would no longer be obligated to pay. You're absolutely correct.
What happens to the mortgage lien that's on his house, on the real property that's been recorded?
Interesting question. In the Columbus case, it's my understanding that a quiet title action is going to be forthcoming. It would be our belief that the mortgage would be ineffective because it's not securing anything.
Well, we took this case on a certified conflict, and it is whether each missed payment under a promissory note yields a new claim. What's your view on the answer to that limited question?
The answer we put right in the front of our brief, which is maybe. Depending upon,
maybe.
Yes, Your Honor, because it depends upon if it's an accelerated note or not. In the case law, the 11th District Court of Appeals, I think, spoke for many courts in this state. There's a lot of case law on the issue of installment notes, not within the context of the mortgage, but installment notes, and are they divisible or indivisible? And the 11th District summed it up, and we included this in our brief, by saying that the general rule is that they are divisible, that each monthly payment is, in fact, a new cause of action. But they go right on to say that the way to get around that is to add an acceleration clause. I believe that can be found at...
But your argument is that if they put the acceleration clause in, your guy promises to pay, they dismiss on the promise he's going to pay, he doesn't, they can't refile, they can't collect, he gets the house mortgage-free for the rest of... life.
Well, let's look at which plaintiffs are going to be affected. It's only those plaintiffs who have filed, there's been nothing done to and dismissed under Rule 41A voluntarily with the right to refile without prejudice, and then have dismissed again. And
we don't consider the fact that there may be negotiations, good faith negotiations, they're dismissing in good faith that your client's going to catch up, so they're trying to give him a break. That's immaterial.
No, I think it would enter into it if they made an agreement. As I've indicated, if they arrive at an agreement which reinstates this loan, now you've in effect you've got a new loan and newly reinstated. It could be a novation.
Even if they don't change any documents, don't do a new recordation, don't do anything else, they just say, okay, your loan's current, go back to paying.
Well, there always is some agreement. No mortgage company is going to allow a reinstatement without something being done. Typically, it is payment of something towards the arrearage, if not all of the arrearage.
Okay,
that's the
so you pay the arrearage, you get it caught up.
Pardon?
Yeah. Okay, so you have an agreement, you get the arrearage caught up, but there's no documentation in terms of a new note, new mortgage, or anything like that recorded. Is that considered a new cause of action in your mind, if they pay up?
Certainly, Your Honor, because there would always be the documentation evidencing the payments, which would bring it caught back up, and there's the oral agreement. If there is a reinstatement, whether it be oral or in writing, filed or not filed, there's in effect a new loan. It's almost invariably got new terms to it as well. The interest rate could change. There might be forgiveness of principal or of some other aspect of the loan. As this court analyzed a back pattern yesterday involving attorney's fees. Attorney's fees might be added, or at least might be attempted to be added, as part of the reinstatement process. And all of these would change the agreement between the debtor and the lender.
How many months was the mortgage in this instance?
It was a 30-year loan.
30-year. So it's right. 360 months.
Yes, right.
And the first foreclosure was filed in 03. And had there been payment up to that point?
There had been payment prior to the default, yes.
Okay, and then there was a default.
There was
and then
a default.
The case was dismissed, and it was refiled in 04 with subsequent months of missed payments. Am I correct?
And yes, Your Honor, and there were no payments made from the alleged default in the first complaint.
Yes.
Throughout today, there's not been a payment.
And then that case in 04 was dismissed, and the third one was filed then at a later point. And had there been additional months of missed payments of the 360?
As I indicated, there has never been a payment since the original default alleged in the first complaint. There have been no payments made all along.
Why would then answer to the question whether or not a missed payment yields a new claim? Because the amount of default at the second filing would be a specific sum, and the amount of default at the third filing would be a greater amount of default. Why would those claims not be different?
Well, the answer to that question, Your Honor, is that the prayer for relief, and had they completed the first foreclosure, would have been an exact sum for the principal plus interest until they collect. That's the way it was prayed for, and that's the way the judgment would have rendered. It would have been $164,000 in the change plus the interest rate at 7.35% on until perpetuity until the judgment's collected. So that judgment that they would have gotten had they proceeded to judgment in the first foreclosure would have encompassed all of the interest on into infinity until they collect. So any subsequent number would, and in this case, you had the exact same amount of principal alleged in all three, or actually all four, complaints. And they all said plus interest. The only difference is they said after seeing the motion to dismiss, which was converted to a motion for summary judgment, then they filed an amended complaint seeking to adjust not the claim, but the remedy. And I believe this court has spoken on the issue of res judicata and remedy in Grava versus Parkman Township, which we cited on page 8 of our brief. When a valid and final judgment rendered in an action extinguishes the plaintiff's claim, the claim extinguished includes all rights of the plaintiff to remedies against the defendant with respect to all or any part of the transaction or series of connected transactions out of which the action arose. In this case, the appellee can only point to the default, which they alleged in their first complaint. That's the same default they alleged in the second complaint, and the same default that they alleged in the third.
And the reason is that that first default, allowed the bank to accelerate the payments, and that's why we get the $164,000, which was the prayer in all three complaints, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
The interest was a little different than the last one, but which appears to be the same claim. The claim didn't change.
It was, precisely.
And the bank controls this. I mean, they can decide whether somebody's going to be allowed to pay to live in their house with no mortgage because they control it. They filed the action. They dismissed it.
Precisely, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that they control it.
Is your client still living in this house?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he's not made any payments since 03?
He hasn't made any payments since the original default.
He doesn't intend to if he wins.
I don't know what he intends to do, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record as to why these cases were two dismissals? Apparently nothing happened.
No, Your Honor.
Or was there some negotiation that...
No, there was... I know what the answer is, but there's nothing in the record to answer your question to support any reason for why they were dismissed.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. McKenzie. Mr. Polinko.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The sole issue before the Court today is whether or not a mispayment under a promissory note and mortgage deed yields a new claim such that successive actions are exempt from the two-dismissal rule under Civil Rule 41. The issue has arisen in light of a conflict between the 10th and 5th District, the 10th District and EMC Mortgage v. Jenkins, whose facts are fairly important, I believe, to Appley's position in this matter. In the 10th District, we had a prior holder of a note and mortgage, that being Chase Bank, file two successive foreclosure actions and dismiss them. Admittedly, much like that's what was before the trial court and court of appeals and now this court in this case. The third successive action was filed by EMC Mortgage, who was an assignee. EMC Mortgage, their claim was for the identical default date, identical principal balance, identical interest rate as the prior two Chase foreclosure actions. EMC had argued in that case that each mispayment created a new cause of action. The 10th District, in citing Oliver, stated that the ruling in Oliver, that being Homecoming's Financial v. Oliver, was not that broad, and that each payment was not that broad to encompass the proposition that each payment miss creates new cause of action. In our case, where we get the conflict, the 5th District did not agree with the 10th District. They stated that under the circumstances of this specific case, I believe they drew a distinction from the EMC case. In the present action, we did admittedly have two prior foreclosure actions that were dismissed.
Do we know why? Does the record reflect what the reason that the bank dismissed the two foreclosure actions?
Mr. Chief Justice, unfortunately, I was not involved in those cases. I do not believe that the record reflects any specific reason for why those cases were dismissed. I know they were voluntarily dismissed.
Where the bank accelerates the loan to make the full amount due and there's a default, here $164,000 plus some dollars, I have a difficult time not seeing how that anything has changed to make that a different claim between the first foreclosure action and the third foreclosure action. It's the same amount of money you're seeking, except for this little thing you did to change the interest rate. But the claim, underlying claim, is still the same, is it not? And can't the bank can certainly control whether this person's going to be let off living in a house without having to pay a mortgage. All you have to do is renegotiate or reinstate, require a payment from him or her, and that starts the clock starting again, does it not, for purposes of Rule 41?
Yes, in general, Mr. Chief Justice, it does. In going back to your original question, it's Appley's position that this is a separate claim, that the first default date claimed in the first and second foreclosures, I believe, was November 1st of 2003. Judgment was rendered on behalf of Appley by the trial court on a default date of April 1st, 2005. We have roughly a two-year gap in payments, a two-year gap that my client, Appley, has forfeited any ability to collect. We have 2 years of interest. We have 2 years of a small principal payment. We have 2 years of advances, legal costs. That can't be collected. That can never be collected. The appellee has to realize that.
But that's not the issue, is it? Mm-hmm. The issue is whether the claim changed under our rule. Was there a different claim filed in the third foreclosure action from the second or the first? And my difficulty is, I'll be very frank, I don't see the claim change. It's the same parties, the same loan, no payments made by the borrower at all. No reinstatement, no renegotiation of the loan, and so how is the claim different?
Mr. Chief Justice, effectively, his loan was reinstated. It was not reinstated by any action of the appellant, but it was effectively reinstated. Once that second dismissal, voluntary dismissal, was filed with the court, that loan, it's Appley's position, was current. Appellant had every opportunity at that point to submit payments without the fear of any type of fees or costs or any threats from appellee as to any of the mispayments before this.
It was current. In other words, you waived all the payments, the underlying payments. I thought it was still $164,000 that you pleaded in the third complaint.
Yes, Your Honor. The principal balance that is...
You waived some of the interest, isn't that what you
did? We waived two years of interest in advances.
But that's not the claim. The claim is for the underlying amount of money he promised to pay, isn't it? Or the borrower promised to pay, $164,000.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, the prayer for relief includes a principal balance plus interest dating from the date of default, plus advances and any other fees. So the claim is in excess, in all actuality, in excess of $164,000. Because when it $164,000 is the principal balance as of the date of default.
So the real legal question for us is where the lender changes the amount of interest it wants to collect on a loan it's attempting to foreclose, and the lender changes the amount of interest sought, that is a new claim, that represents a new claim, rather than this mispayment standard error question we've got in the certified question. That's really what we have to decide, isn't it?
Well, given the circumstances, Your Honor, that is Appley's position, that third filing with the effective change to April 1st, 2005 as a new default date, which is premised upon the second dismissal entry, has created a new claim. It changes the monetary judgment. The principal balance it was not changed.
When the bank did the second dismissal, was there any notification in writing to the homeowner that payments could begin again, and there was that the interest was waived off for those 2 years, and taxes that had been advanced or anything else that had been advanced by the bank that the bank was entitled to recover under the contract, that those had all been waived off? And
Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. I have not seen any type of documentation from Appley stating that was waived.
So when the bank, would be fair to say, when the bank filed the third one, and I'm assuming maybe a different attorney filed the third one than filed the first and second.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That attorney looked at this and said, we're dead unless we allege in this complaint that we have waived off the interest and taxes for 2 years. And then that changes the nature of what this suit is about. And so this is a fresh lawsuit. So that was a, am I correct, that was a conscious decision by counsel, an enterprising and intelligent counsel faced with this dilemma of saying this is how we can bring this back to life, is waive that off. And that would be the first point at which this homeowner had any notice that that's all waived.
Your Honor, as I stated before, I am unsure as whether or not the client sent anything out. But I would agree that counsel who had filed a third foreclosure did see the case history, did see the two dismissals, and in my opinion made a very intelligent and, dare I say, excellent decision in filing it the way, in proceeding in that third foreclosure the way
you were thinking did. Crafty, but you said excellent instead.
The lawyer's probably watching.
Did that answer your question, Ron?
Yes.
Okay. The hypothetical that Appley had presented within their brief, granted, was possibly an extreme hypothetical, but nonetheless it's possible, in which Appley stated that a mortgagor could go into default, reinstate, default again, reinstate once again. But under appellant's argument, as Appley understood, that acceleration, accelerating the note twice, which those two foreclosures would have done, would have barred any third filing.
He appears to be disclaiming that position now, because I thought that was his argument, too. And now he appears to be arguing that only if everything is identical is it a third dismissal prohibited. It doesn't seem to hinge as much on the acceleration as he seemed to originally argue in his brief.
Yes, my understanding was the same as yours, Your Honor. Hence the hypothetical.
He seems to be conceding now that bringing payments up, anything you do that constitutes a change to bring the loan current, gets rid of the fact that you had an acceleration in the complaint, starts it new, even though you don't have any new paperwork filed, which isn't the gist I got from his brief, but he seems to be conceding that at this point.
In this instance, Your Honor, the mortgagor, as appellant's counsel stated, has taken absolutely no affirmative action to address the default, certainly after the second dismissal. Appellee's position is, through no fault of appellant, his mortgage was reinstated. As I outlined prior, the interest and the advances, the fees and costs that are attributed to that loan based upon the default have been waived. That third filing gave notice to appellant that he was able to. He could see the date. And certainly, as the case progressed to the motion to dismiss, converted to a motion for summary judgment, the issues came out. Appellant would have known at that time.
Counsel, I haven't looked at the pleadings, but you just listening to this raises another interesting. Did the pleadings in the third one specifically say we're waiving that, or did they just begin by saying this is the principal and we're asking only for principal and interest from this date forward? Was there an affirmative statement that we've waived off this two-year amount of interest in taxes and attorney fees? Or did they just say, this is our claim, 164 plus interest from this date forward?
Your Honor, as appellant's counsel had pointed out, the third filing of the foreclosure, the date in principal balance was the same as the date and principal balance on the second foreclosure. It was during the prosecution of that third foreclosure that Appley moved for leave to amend its complaint, which was granted by the trial court. And at that time, Appley had amended to the default date of April 1st, 2005. I believe counsel had pled in the alternative. So while there was no affirmative statement from Appley within the complaint stating we will waive X, Y, and Z, it was affirmatively stated in there that the new default date was April 1st, 2005, and a review of the prior pleadings, even the first initial complaint filed in the third foreclosure, would bring to light the fact that there's 2 years in there that Appley was not attempting to go after.
Mr. Polinko, I'd like to turn your attention to something else. You had stated earlier that the dismissal reinstated the claim. Doesn't the mortgage, though, have a specific statement about what needs to be done to reinstate the debt?
The mortgage agreement in the promissory, now you will find language in there, much like the case that was argued yesterday before this court. There is a clause in regard to reinstatement. In many cases, it's not a right to reinstate. It's an opportunity.
Right, but there's a specific segment there that talks about what has to be done for reinstatement. And as opposing counsel said, this involves documentation, agreement, to show that there is a new agreement between the parties. Is there anything within your mortgage that suggests that the bank could unilaterally determine to reinstate the mortgage?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I'm not sure if there's any specific language, certainly not considering the circumstances in this case, which admittedly are rather strange. But I think I would submit that a lender in my client's position to protect their interest in the property could take such a step. It's to the benefit of the mortgagor. It was the benefit of the mortgagor in this instance to he received the benefit. Those 2 years were waived.
How do you resolve, then, the certified question in this case? Not based on the facts, but it's really an abstract question about missed payments on a promissory note yielding a new claim. The answer would technically be, according to what you're arguing, that but for the modification here, that would be waived under 41, wouldn't it? Is that your response?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you, I apologize. Can you rephrase that?
Here. We took the case in on a certified conflict, and the simple question is whether or not each missed payment under a promissory note yields a new claim for purposes of the two dismissal rule under Civil Rule 41. So in our resolution of that question, I'm trying to solicit your response to that, and I'm understanding your response is that a missed payment would be subject to dismissal under 41, would it not?
Your Honor, I think that it is, in my opinion, a very hard question to answer. I think the circumstances of this specific case, what has caused the conflict in between the 10th and 5th District, it was the circumstances of the EMC case and the Oliver case, which led to that inclusion in the paragraph of the court's decision. I think that...
But politely, the only reason that you think you can prevail in this case is because Alert Counsel decided to ask the court for leave to amend the pleadings to change the nature of the claim. And but for that, I think you would agree that you would be subject to the two dismissal rule and you could not have filed that third claim because it would be the same.
Your Honor, thank you. I'm clear on your question. I would agree. I would agree. The facts in EMC are distinguishable from our specific case. The facts in EMC, you have three separate foreclosures, each one listing the identical default date, the identical principal balance interest rate, and so on and so forth. In that case, I can see that EMC had proposed that each missed payment created a new claim, and the court rejected that. I can understand that in that situation. In this situation, I think the circumstances are different. You know, as stated, it was Alert Counsel. He had made the request for leave to amend the complaint to adjust
right.
That
I
default.
I think we understand. Thank you very much.
Let me, just before you sit down, let me ask you another question about the acceleration, and I don't know that this question was answered. The acceleration in this on this property, I guess, done by a separate written notice to the borrower, or was it done in the pleadings when a foreclosure action was started?
Your Honor, in this instance, it was done within the pleadings. When a foreclosure action is initiated, of course, the FDCPA letter goes out. Prior to that time, in most circumstances, 2 or 3 months prior to that time, the mortgagor is receiving correspondence directly from the lender without counsel's involvement at that time, telling them they're in default. Usually the last letter stating it could go into foreclosure, but it's the actual complaint that talks about the acceleration of the note.
Well, if that's the case, then if the acceleration is done in the action itself, when that's dismissed and it's over, it doesn't proceed, doesn't that sort of undo the acceleration then?
If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, when that foreclosure is filed and that acceleration clause kicks in, when that case is dismissed, that acceleration is essentially decelerated. That loan,
because it never goes to a final judgment.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Because it doesn't go to a final judgment on that action.
Yes, Your Honor. That's it. So at every dismissal, in this case, the acceleration clause again is decelerated. The loan's not accelerated. We're back to the default date.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Polenko.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. McKenzie, you've saved almost a minute of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor and Justices, this is not a case of a different claim. It's a case of a different remedy. The proposition that there was a reinstatement, that would require an agreement. A reinstatement is a contract, and there was, as Pelley pointed out, the notice of the alleged reinstatement occurred in the pleadings, not with any attempt to negotiate a reinstatement. There was never, if it ever existed, it's unilateral. And as the court pointed out, there are provisions, and it was admitted by the Pelley, there are provisions in the mortgage agreement for reinstatement. The other case law supports the position that we have taken in this matter, including the main case and including all of Ohio case law. It all supports the position we have taken. The only ones that have decided that there is a divisible contract are the ones that say if there's no acceleration, or alternatively, if there is a cure or a reinstatement. Absent those, all case law would find in favor of what we've indicated.
I'm going to ask if you would respond to your theory of the acceleration, when it was done, and
the mortgage contract actually contains a provision that requires a 30-day written notice prior to any filing. It's in the documentation in the supplement that we have submitted. There's nothing in the record to confirm that was actually done, but the provision is in the contract laying out how they would effectuate an acceleration. And I would say that the dismissal doesn't extinguish or decelerate the loan. The dismissal operated as an adjudication on the merits. So, Your Honor, there was a final judgment on the merits in this case.
The second dismissal.
On the second dismissal. And it was an identical claim. The facts in this case are identical to the EMC mortgage case.
You've used your time, Mr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Counsel, you're excused. We have an admission ceremony following oral arguments. The next matter on our calendar is the admission motion of attorneys to the Bar of Ohio. Our procedure will be as follows. I'll ask each presenter to come forward when I call your name, and if you'll state briefly the reason you believe the applicant you're representing would make an excellent member of the bar. I'd ask that the applicants please stand in place while you're being introduced, and at the end of the introductions, I'll ask Justice O'Connor to administer the oath of office. The first presenter is Joseph Navin.
Chief Justice, members of the court, thank you for giving me the opportunity to appear here today to admit or to nominate Mr. Adam Berger for membership in the Ohio Bar. Mr. Berger is a member of the court in the Ohio Bar. Mr. Berger has moved to Ohio from Pennsylvania, where he worked as an attorney for many years. He was licensed, or is licensed now, in the state of Pennsylvania and in the state of New Jersey, as his residence at that time was in Philadelphia, and he practiced in both states under both the rules of both bars. Mr. Berger and I met when he moved to Ohio because he was attending seminars to learn about Ohio law, and we met through his participation in various seminars, and he came to work for me as a non-attorney in my small law office in Zanesville, Ohio, where he has spent the last 6 months learning more and more about Ohio. And during the time I have known Mr. Berger during these 6 months, he has shown the aptitude, the integrity, the ability, and the professionalism, I believe, to be a great member of the Ohio Bar, and I would respectfully submit his application to you here today.
Thank you. Tracy Hawkins.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, thank you for seeing us today. I'm here to present Bradley G. Braun for admission to the Ohio Bar. I have known Mr. Braun as a friend and a colleague in law school for 12 years. We have practiced and participated on cases for the last 8 years. He is a resident of Northern Kentucky, which is right outside of the area of Cincinnati, and would like to bring his practice onto this side of the river. So I respectfully present Brad for consideration.
Robin Lampkin.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. I have been acquainted with Amy Lynn Butler professionally for the last 7 years, both practicing in a corporate setting handling environmental matters. And I know Ms. Butler to be a member of good moral character and a proper person to be admitted to the Ohio Bar, and I recommend her for admission to practice before the state of Ohio. Thank you.
Thank you. Adele Schenck.
Morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors. I'm here to recommend that Jenny Elizabeth Carroll be admitted to the Bar of Ohio. I have been working with Ms. Carroll in the last several months. I met her approximately a year ago in the last several months in her capacity as director of the Innocence Project, academic director at the University of Cincinnati. We've had many discussions about the law, particularly on innocence issues and how they work within the constitutional framework of the criminal justice system. I have found her to be dedicated to the pursuit of justice and deeply committed to the protection of individual rights. She would be an asset to the Bar of Ohio, and I recommend her.
Thank you. Jeffrey Landon.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I am here to present Bill Geisen. Mr. Geisen and I am disturbed to recollect, have known each other for over 35 years. He is an attorney in Northern Kentucky, affiliated with our firm, Graydon, Head & Ritchie. He is a graduate of Xavier University with honors and a graduate of the University of Kentucky College of Law. He is a person of excellent character and great ability, and I recommend him for admission to the Bar of Ohio.
Thank you. Thomas Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Thomas Sullivan. I'm a member in good standing of the Ohio Bar and have been so since 2004. I'm here to present Ms. Beth Whitman for admittance in Ohio. Ms. Whitman is a 2000 graduate of Wayne State University Law School. Following law school, she was a prosecutor in Wayne County, Michigan, is currently admitted in the state of Michigan and the Eastern District of Michigan in the federal court, and she joined the firm I represent, also the Kitch firm, in 2002. She focuses her practice in appellate work. She is a associate principal in our firm, and on the occasions that I have to mangle a case in the trial level, I have often sought her counsel at the appellate level, found her to be intelligent, dependable, with a high level of integrity, and I recommend her without reservation for admission in Ohio.
Thank you. Is there a motion that the applicants be admitted to the bar?
So moved.
Hearing no objections, the applicants will please come forward and follow the directions of the Marshals, and Justice O'Connor will administer the oath. Justice O'Connor.
Good morning. If you will raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, state your name.
I, William Geisen.
Hereby swear.
Hereby swear.
That I will support the Constitution. And the laws of the United States.
And the laws of the United States.
And the Constitution.
And the Constitution.
And the laws of Ohio.
The laws of Ohio.
And I will abide by the rules.
I will abide by the rules.
Of professional conduct.
Of professional conduct.
In my capacity as an attorney and officer of the court.
In my capacity as an attorney and officer of the court.
I will conduct myself with dignity.
Conduct myself with dignity.
And civility.
Civility.
And show respect.
And show respect.
Towards judges.
Towards judges.
Court staff.
Court staff.
Clients.
Clients.
Fellow professionals.
Fellow professionals.
And all others.
And all others.
I will honestly.
I will honestly.
Faithfully.
Faithfully.
And competently.
And competently.
Discharge the duties.
Discharge the duties.
Of an attorney at law.
Of an attorney at law.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
On behalf of the court and the Bar of Ohio, I congratulate you, welcome you to the bar. We have a very strong bar in Ohio. We're very proud of our bar, and we hope it's at least as strong as it was before you were members. Thank you. Good luck. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.